Well, hello and welcome to this podcast recording of Two Guys on Your Head. So we've done three of these with KUT. And at the first one, we had one audience member. And the second, we had about eight at the end. So this is like, woohoo, this is like a full house. So thanks for coming out.
Yes.
So typically how we record these is we just kind of think of a topic and then we go and riff and have a conversation about that. And then I cut it up afterward. So today we thought we'd make it applicable to South By since Amy Wonky, thank you so much for inviting us to record here. So we're going to talk about creativity, the psychology of creativity, and the myth of invention. I'm Rebecca McEnroy with KUT. This here is Dr. Art Markman with the Human Dimensions of Organization unit at UT and author of Smart Thinking and Smart Change. And I can never remember the name of your book, but you've written stuff. And this is Dr. Bob Duke.
I've written stuff.
You've written lots of stuff.
That's it.
And he teaches at the Butler School of Music.
Yeah.
Yes.
Great.
So, creativity. Where to begin?
So here at South by Southwest, we really prize innovation and creativity. I think the Onion headline from the other day said, the term innovation used 650,000 times in the first day of South by Southwest. And I think one of the fascinating things about this is that we don't necessarily think a lot about where creativity comes from when we're engaged with thinking about innovation. And so one of the things that might be fun to talk about is in particular, the importance of the reuse of ideas. So one of the things that happens when you're being creative, you might think, well, when I'm being creative, what I'm really trying to do is to do something that no one's ever done before and therefore has no precedent whatsoever in people's lives. But in fact, a lot of the creative inventions that have been very successful are ones in which what people have really done is to take a concept that applied well in one area and really plop it down by analogy in another area. And so it's not so much that you've come up with something that is brand new, nobody's ever thought of anything like it. Really what's happened is they've never thought of anything of that particular juxtaposition before. And it is that juxtaposition of two ideas by analogy that turns out to have a lot of power.
And one of the implications, of course, of what Art's talking about is that in order to apply other ideas, you have to know stuff. And I think many people who try to encourage creativity and want people to sort of just stretch themselves and think about outside the box and all those phrases that people use.
Where is that box?
I know. Where is that box? Underestimate how much people who actually exercise creativity and are successfully creative, how much they know about lots of different things. I mean, almost all the creative people in the world that people study systematically or that people know informally, all of those people are broadly educated, widely read people who know a lot about a lot of things. And Art has written very engagingly about people who have made real contributions to particular fields of study, even though what they had applied was something in a field that no one would understand why they were even reading about that other field or looking at that other field.
You know, but one thing I think is really fascinating, who's been to the Memory Observatory? Did you guys go to that? Anybody been to that yet? So there's this thing that they have, this Memory Observatory, and it brings back kind of like your emotional connection to a photo, you know, through a picture. And I think we should talk about creativity and memory, because I think a lot of times we think there's this direct link between where we saw something and the memory associated with that. But can you talk about how we fool ourselves into thinking we remember the actual event versus what we actually remember and how and why we remember it that way?
Well, all right. So there's a whole bunch of pieces related to creativity and memory, and I think we need to get all of those together. So the first thing we need to remember is that the knowledge that we have, that's all stuff that resides in memory. And to pick up first on something that Bob was saying, one of the things that creative people do is that they learn a number of things that they didn't realize they were going to need to know at the time. And I think this is actually really crucial. So let's take some examples just to start with. So we'll start first with James Dyson, right? Dyson invented the Dyson vacuum. And what he did with the Dyson vacuum was to eliminate the bag by... And how the way he eliminated the bag was actually to recognize that in some fundamental way, vacuum cleaners at home were like sawmills. And the way that they're like sawmills is that sawmills have to suck sawdust out of the air, only most of the time, instead of having a big, gigantic vacuum cleaner bag on them, they have a device called an industrial cyclone, which is a big cone-shaped device. Air comes in, it swirls around, and then the sawdust gets thrown to the side. And what he did was to actually build a little industrial cyclone inside of a vacuum cleaner. To take another example, George Demestral was a Swiss engineer, walked his dog a lot. We all love dogs. And his dog would get covered with cockle burrs. Most people were content just to peel the cockle burrs off the dog's fur. But actually what Demestral did was he analyzed those cockle burrs under a microscope, discovered the reason that they stick to a dog's fur is because they have little hooks on them, get tangled in the fur. And so he then went out and got people to build little synthetic cockle burr hooks, little synthetic dog fur, and got Velcro. Okay. So again, what's interesting about this is he went about just exploring some things, and both Dyson and Demestral and lots of other inventors went out looking at things that didn't appear to be at all relevant when they went looking at these things in the first place, but ultimately were able to use this information out of memory to do something else. And this leads to really an important point, because as a college professor, and Bob and I are both college professors, so we know that our least favorite question that any student ever asks is, of course, is this going to be on the exam? And I'm sick and tired of that question. And for the first 20 odd years of my career, I had no idea how to answer that question. And I finally realized that the appropriate answer to that question, when a student says, is this going to be on the exam? The answer to that question is yes, but it might not be my exam. Because you never know when you're going
to
need that.
Is that what you say? You've said that to people?
Yes, I do.
God.
Yeah. No wonder my course evaluation is right there.
I just want to add one thing to that about the apparent purposelessness of much of learning. I think people who want...
three times fast.
Yeah, exactly. No, I'm not even going to try. A lot of people who desire to be creative or want their children to be creative or want people they work with to be creative, imagine that there's some pathway to creativity, not recognizing the fact, as Art said it a minute ago, much of what we may apply creatively to problems we encounter in the future is not understood by us when we're learning those things. And I think what most people who find themselves ready to be creative have done is, getting back to Rebecca's question about memory, is filled their memories with things about which they're curious and about which they're interested, even though it might not have an apparent direct application to some problem that you're facing right now. And one of the challenges thinking about in a teaching environment, whether it's for colleges or for little kids who are in kindergarten or preschool or whatever, is allowing people to pursue curiosity even when it doesn't have an obviously productive outcome. In that, pursuing the curiosity is in fact the productive outcome, even though it doesn't actually produce an object, an idea, something that you can show and say, I created that.
And I want to emphasize something there, because our school system to some degree and also the companies that employ the people who come out of our school system are often very focused on productivity. If you think about management is all about making our workers productive. And the problem with productivity is, at the same time that we talk about wanting people to be productive, companies are also talking about wanting to be innovative. And it turns out you can't do both of those at the same time. So if you are going to prize productivity, then you are going to pay a hit on your innovativeness, because, as Bob was saying, creativity and it really requires learning a bunch of things that don't have obvious application right now. So you have to be willing to spend some amount of time doing things that don't have an obvious purpose right now. And just to give you an example of what this means, a lot of people, when they talk about companies like Google, make a big deal over the fact that Google has that idea of 20% time, that employees should be able to spend 20% of their time working on projects that don't have a clear monetized goal in the moment. What's missing in the analyses of that is actually an important point, that if someone's going to give you 20% time or even 10% time, it means that company needs to overhire. It means you actually need to have 20% more people working for you than you, strictly speaking, need to finish the tasks that you're doing in order to be able to succeed. And most of us are so worried about productivity, so worried about efficiency, that we don't really think about the fact that we actually need to have excess capacity if we're going to succeed at being creative.
And just to follow up on this for just a sec. You can go take a break now. Is it one of the things that that requires that we don't often talk about when we're talking about creativity is the notion of patience? There are no impatient people who are really wildly creative, because you have to do some things, as Art's saying, that don't have immediate outcomes. You have to make a lot of mistakes. You have to do a lot of things that don't actually lead to some success right away. And one of the things that's a challenge for all of us, whether we're dealing with children or students or ourselves or our coworkers or our employees, I think I got everybody in there, is allowing the patience to wait for things to happen in a time that might not be of our own choosing.
And it's not, sorry, Rebecca, I can't help it.
My life. It's
not just that you have to have patience. You also have to have a tolerance for uncertainty, because real creativity involves a process essentially that feels like wandering in the desert a little bit. I know I'm doing the right kinds of things. I know I am doing things that are correlated with being productive. I am trying things. I am learning new things. I'm creating these juxtapositions. But unlike a really good productivity system at work that says, you are here, I'm in step 3 of 18 in my task, with creativity, it's more like, I feel like I'm on step 1. I feel like I'm on step 1. I feel like I'm on step 1. Now I'm on step 18,
yeah.
Right? And so you don't really have that clear sense of progress from beginning to end, and you have to trust in the process that despite the fact that it doesn't feel like you're making progress, you actually are.
And you know, one thing about this that's difficult if you're an employer or a teacher is that there are a lot of people who will stay on step 1, and actually they're not doing anything.
Right.
So it isn't like as soon as you do that, you know, good things will happen because enough people will have an opportunity. There are some people who are really kind of lazy and they just want to stay on step 1 because they don't want to work hard.
Well, they don't want to stay on step 1. They want to appear to be on step 1. And that's that is the problem, right?
Yeah.
It's hard to tell the difference purely from a productivity standpoint between those people who are working hard and working the process the right way and are going to land something,
right,
and those who are not really pedaling so hard.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, I'm going to talk now.
You should.
Okay, here we go.
You should.
So here's the thing, though. I mean, we're at South By, where everybody, I swear, has a story about like their creative process from point A to point B and how they got there and how they're going to monetize it and why you should invest in it. And it's like, why is that story so important to us? Why do we need that story of innovation and invention and how things are working and, you know, that like clean sweep?
We love stories.
Yeah.
So one of the things that's really important, this is a point that Bob and I have made several times on the podcast before, is that people's life stories are only clear in retrospect, right? So in the forward direction, life is chaotic. Things happen, and you're not really sure whether what you're doing is going to succeed. Then you look back on it, you go, oh, yeah, that was the pivotal moment. And, of course, you also grant yourself some 20/20 hindsight in that. So you're like, oh, yeah, that was the pivotal moment. And, of course, I knew that if I took this step, that it was going to lead to this next step and so on. When, in fact, if we had been able to get you at the time and ask you, how's it going? You'd be like, oh, I don't know. I'm not sure. But the thing is, so on the one end, we like to tell those stories. But I think, and we'll let Bob talk about this, people, I think, like to hear those kinds of stories, too.
But what does Daniel Kahneman say? Hindsight is the biggest fallacy of mankind?
Well,
hindsight
sure.
is 2020 is the yeah, biggest fallacy
sure.
of mankind.
And it, yeah, it may or may not be that. We got a lot of big fallacies.
Because
that's the biggest
because
one.
The stories that we create are most often not high fidelity. I mean, they make sense to us because we make them make sense to us. So we will pull in ideas and facts and events that may or may not fit together in reality in terms of the past, but they make sense to us now. And so we have a tremendous capacity, because our brains are trying to make sense of the world, right? And so sometimes the world doesn't make sense. There's lots of stuff that happens that's just random. It's not purposeful at all. So we find reasons for things to happen. And, you know, people say all the time, well, everything happens for a reason. Well, actually, no, it doesn't. I mean, stuff just happens. And sometimes people who have the capability to do so make something good come of those sometimes random events, and other people don't.
But one of the things that's really important is, so this gets back to South By. If I'm trying to get you to invest in me, I need you to believe in me. And the only way that you're going to believe in me is if you think there's some real causal power that's going to make sure that I succeed in the future. And the best way to make you believe that I have that causal power is to make myself the hero of the story. And so there are two things that happen to that story that are so important. One is there is a story that makes all of that chaos seem like it actually had a purpose from the beginning. But then the other is it overemphasizes my contribution to the process. And of course, this leads to the overall myth of creativity, the myth of the innovator or the creator. So oftentimes, one of the things we like to do in the end is to have a person that we credit as being the inventor of something. So Alexander Graham Bell, the inventor of the telephone, because he got his patent in 4 hours before his competitor for this substantively the same invention. You know, Thomas Edison, the inventor of the electric light bulb, where in fact what really is the case, it was Edison and his lab are the creators of the filament that doesn't burn out too fast. Because in fact, lots of people had already developed the idea for the incandescent bulb. But we don't talk about that community because at the end of the day, we need a person that we're willing to invest in. And so as an investor, you want to have the confidence that you're doing the right thing, and you need that story as part of what gives you that confidence.
Yeah. So I think, I mean, since we have some people here and we have a little bit of time, I think we should take some questions because we never get to do that.
Yeah, that's true.
Lucas, do you have another microphone or should I come down and do that? I'm just going to do that. Do you have any questions?
Does anybody have a question?
Because I won't get up if you don't
have questions. Because we can keep talking.
Okay, we'll keep talking. If you have a question, raise your hand and I'll come. Oh, look at that. He was hesitant for a hot second. But
ask the psychologist.
I've always wanted to do this on television.
The doctors are in.
Hiya. How y'all doing? Can you hear me a little bit? Okay, cool. So you were talking about creativity before, right? And like the, not the spark, but like what can hinder or help creativity. Do you ever deal with or have ways to deal with like the writer's blocks of the world and creative blocks? And
we do.
Sometimes people say to get over writer's block, you look at other mediums, right, to get inspiration. Is that taking too much inspiration from someone else's work? It's kind of a double question.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, there is no new thing under the sun, and I borrowed that line, actually. I think there's several things to say. We've talked about writer's block in the past and things like that. And I'll start by saying the most important thing you can do to overcome, say, writer's block is to write. And I think in many cases what people are worried about is that the thing that they're writing in that moment isn't brilliant. But of course, one of the things that we forget is that the first draft of almost anything that almost anybody writes isn't brilliant. And so one of the things we end up doing a lot when we write is comparing the words that flow from our fingers as we're typing to the beautiful prose that we've read of other people that we admire as it stands at the point where it got published. Not because we have no access to what that prose looked like when it emerged from their fingers. And what we need to recognize is that a big part of writing is rewriting, and that you can't rewrite until you've got something to start with.
And, you know, I think a lot of people who say, you know, nothing's coming when I'm writing, there's just nothing coming. Actually, the reality is nothing's coming that you're not rejecting out of hand. It's not that nothing's coming. It's that that's no good. Not that. And so you have a feeling like nothing's coming because you're editing before you even get anything on a page. This isn't just about writing. It's about creating almost anything, right? And as Art says, the biggest distance is from nothing to something. Once you get something, now you have things that you can respond to and react to and observe as you change it, right? But one of the things that people, I think about when they're stuck is they imagine that the reason I'm stuck is that I just can't think of anything. But what we all do all the time is we self-edit before we actually let something go all the way through because we say, well, that's not going to be any good, and we stop. And one of the things that sort of writing, just writing, does is it sends you down pathways that you might not be very confident in, but at least you're moving, right? So you're actually doing something. And I think when people are trying to get creative, which is a sort of a weird thing to think about it like that, right? Their thought is, well, I've got to wait, use the word inspiration in your question. You know, I have to be inspired to do something. Certainly, inspiration is at some points important in creativity. But what's more important than that is not self-censoring, but allowing yourself to put stuff out. I mean, just for yourself, put stuff on your computer or on a legal pad or painting or something that allows you to generate things that you can then respond to.
And I think there's two things to pick up on there that are really important. The first is that often we do a lousy job in our own editing in terms of deciding what actually would be of interest to someone else. I know I do a lot of blogging, and some of the blog entries that people have responded to most favorably turn out to be ones that I got about this close to just not posting because I thought, no one's going to be interested in this. I don't think I really nailed this. And then I said, all right, you know, I went through the work, I'll put this up, and suddenly I'm getting a lot of positive feedback for it. So what that means is sometimes get some stuff out there and then get another pair of eyeballs on it to get some feedback on where it is. And the other thing is, one of the things you said at the beginning of your question was, well, if you get inspiration from someone else, is that being just too derivative? And, you know, maybe, but try it, right? I mean, not everything that we write or create needs to be something that ever sees the light of day. Sometimes the things that we write are just stepping stones to something better later. And so by writing something that might feel very derivative, it gives you the confidence to finish something. It gives you, maybe there's, you know, if you're writing fiction, maybe a character says something that's really interesting and you go back to that later and think, you know, I could build something around that, right? And so that whole process of just going through the writing rather than staring at the empty page, no matter what comes out, turns out to be an inspiration for what comes next.
You know, there's an interesting series of studies that sort of illustrates this point pretty dramatically that was done a number of years ago about productivity among psychologists who have written important papers. And they looked at both over the arc of a career and between individual psychologists. Now, the reason we know about people who have written important papers, the reason we know about it because they wrote the important papers. And our memory being what they are, think, well, those are the only papers I've ever read of theirs, so that's what they wrote. Well, you know what I'm going to say because I wouldn't be telling the story, right? Is that the people who have written more important papers have just written more papers. And they're not all beautiful, and some of them are very forgettable. And what artists said many times is the best way to, you know, get more good ideas is to get more ideas. And many times, because we're waiting for just the right one to come out, right? We don't take the opportunity not only to get feedback for the attempts that don't ever go anywhere, right? But we're actually practicing generating things. Because if you only wait to generate really great stuff, you're not going to generate very much, so you're not getting a lot of practice. And that practice is an important part of becoming more creative and more skillful in what you do.
The thing is, though, I mean, a lot of it speaks to this notion that we need to be okay with frustration. You know, we need to be okay with being in that space that is very uncomfortable, you know, that space between like having an idea but not really perfecting the idea. But I don't think that the way that we live now in this kind of like modern high-tech, everything's amazing world gives us tools to learn how to be and deal with frustration. So how can you do that?
Yeah. Well, so one thing we have to learn to do is to live with our own imperfection, right? So that's a piece of it, is that we hold very high standards for ourselves, and I'm a believer in high standards, but I think that the fact that you ultimately want to achieve great things doesn't mean that greatness comes out immediately. There's several things I think we need to do in order to help ourselves deal with frustration. One of those is to remember that if you're engaged in any creative pursuit, that there is a trade-off between that creativity and productivity. And part of what gets frustrating in any situation is when we feel like we're making insufficient progress. Because now we feel like I should be further along by now, and that's the frustration. If you recognize that actually the creative process itself operates in a series of fits and starts, then it's less frustrating when you may have gone a week or 2 weeks or 4 weeks or a year without feeling like you've nailed it yet, because you recognize that's actually the way it works.
Yeah. You know, Art and I work, we supervise a lot of graduate students who are writing dissertations, and they all often look to us to say, well, just tell me how I should set this up. Well, if I knew how to set it up, it wouldn't be worth a dissertation because I'd already know how to do it and it would have been published already, right? But one of the things I think that our students are frustrated by is how long we keep them on figuring out the question. Because their first thought is, okay, I'm going to do a dissertation. Okay, I'm going to have three groups. And I said, wait a minute, what are you trying to find out? Well, three groups and then the first group. And I said, wait a minute, what are you trying to find out? Because what they want to do is move to action. And what I'm trying to do is slow them down and keep them in a thinking process where they're imagining, are you really clear-headed about what you're trying to accomplish? Now, for many of them, they're thinking, look, we're wasting time. You know, days are going by. You're still asking me to answer the same damn question over and over again. I need to get going, you know? I need to file an IRB. I got to get moving. Well, no. All those sayings that we've come up in life, you know, like carpenters say, measure twice, cut once, all that kind of stuff, it's all true across domains of human activity. I mean, the biggest enemy of creativity is speed. Right? If you try to go fast, the likelihood that you're going to actually capture what you're capable of doing is relatively low compared to taking the time to go slower and imagine the possibilities at each step along the way.
Yeah. And this is true not just for people who view themselves as being creative types. This is true for organizations that are trying to be creative in particular yeah. situations. So, for example, you know, a lot of times companies will get a group together to do some kind of group idea generation. And they'll even say, you know what, we're going to get together for two whole days to do this. Now, of course, the company expects that this idea is going to change the course of humanity. And so we're going to allocate two whole days to it. Now, the interesting thing about that is if you're going to allocate two whole days, one of the things you want to do is to make sure you spend at least one whole day just defining the problem.
Yeah.
So that you are, and people are very frustrated by this. So after, I've done this before. After about an hour, they're like, all right, we know the problem. Let's get to solving it. And you have to keep reminding them, you're trying to change humanity. Let's spend a little bit more time thinking about the problem. Because, and the reason that this is important gets back to memory. See, this all fits together.
It does, doesn't it?
Memory retrieval happens automatically. All right, if I say to you, remember a birthday party you attended, everybody remembers a birthday party they attended. It doesn't take any effort to do that. That's the way memory works. So the way that you frame the problem you're trying to solve fundamentally influences what information comes out of people's memories, which then influences the nature of the problem that's being solved. So if you rush to define the problem, you haven't necessarily explored all of the cues that you might use to reach into memory to pull out possibilities that might change the way that you think about that problem. And that's the reason that finding different ways to describe the problem is so important, because ultimately in creativity, Bob used the wonderful phrase early on, thinking outside the box. And when you use that phrase, thinking outside the box, apparently, people assume there's like some extra cognitive process people have that we engage in particularly important creative situations that allows us to do something completely different from what we've ever done. That ain't it.
Yeah.
It turns out all you can do is remember something you know that is going to help you to solve the problem. And if you're not currently remembering anything to help you solve the problem, it means you haven't asked your memory the right question yet. And that the only thing you can do then is to ask your memory a different question. And the only way to do that is to describe the problem in a different way.
Yeah.
And that's why you got to spend half your time defining the problem.
Yeah. And, you know, when Art's talking about just the natural recall, the activities of memory, just being able to recall things, you know, a lot of what happens when creativity happens is below conscious awareness. There are a lot of things that our brains put together in ways that we did not willfully imagine, right? There, the reason people say, you know, I was taking a shower and this idea came to me, or I was taking a walk and I thought about this thing, or I was out for a run and this thing occurred to me. Why is that? It happens, is that people say that all the time, and they're not just making stuff up. It happens because when we're trying to think of something, our minds are engaged in a way that often doesn't allow some information to come in that would really be very useful, because we're working so hard to come up with the right thing. And when our minds go somewhere else, when our attention goes somewhere else, our brains are quite good at figuring out ways to piece things together that we wouldn't consciously have come to with our own, thinking about it purposefully.
And that means also, not only is it good to take a shower, to take a walk, it's also really good to take a nap, because we are a chronically underslept society. We have such sleep deprivation. You know, and you know this because anyone who ever sits down like to read something and after 5 minutes of reading they find themselves nodding off, that means you're not getting enough sleep. Now, one of the things that happens when you sleep is that you actually begin to lose some of the details of things you've been thinking about. And those details that you lose, now when you wake up and think about the problem again, That's a new draw into memory. You're reaching back into memory with a new cue, and that new cue has fewer details in it, which means it has the opportunity to retrieve something else that is like what you're thinking about in a more abstract way. So sometimes when people say, you know what, I'm going to sleep on it, that's actually really good advice.
Are there any other questions? I don't want to miss one. Here we go.
Hi, thanks. I listened to you guys, I think it's Friday mornings or something, so it's really cool to see y'all in person. So he was asking about kind of writer's block, and you said just keep writing, and you just said sometimes you need to sleep and run.
Yep.
So, like, how do you know what to do in that moment? Like, if I'm stuck, do I just keep writing and writing and writing? Like, when do I walk away kind of thing?
Are you chronically stuck or stuck just once? I mean, because that matters. So some people who say they have writer's block mean, I got up today, and I wanted to write, and every other day that I write, I do just fine, and today I'm not doing so well. You know what? If it's one day, go for a run or take a nap. At the point where it's not just one day, it's a thing, then that chronic writer's block, the solution to that is write. You know, no matter how awful it is, just write, and don't throw it away, and don't burn it, write. And then read it later and see what inspiration that gives you, and then write again. Or, you know, don't write something new, actually edit that. I mean, I the joke I use on this a lot is, you know, when I was a kid, I had one of those joke books that was all dinosaur jokes, which I guess were big back in the day.
They're
and,
still big.
And big, yeah. And they one of the jokes in there was, how do you make a statue of a dinosaur? And it was, take a block of marble and cut away everything that doesn't look like a dinosaur. And I know, it was like five, you know, I thought it was good. I'm still telling it, though.
I still love that joke.
But the thing is, a lot of times writing is actually like that. That you have to just get a block of text out there and then cut away everything that doesn't look like a dinosaur, right? And so sometimes the trick at first is to get way too much out there, stuff that doesn't really feel good or look good, and then allow yourself to edit that. Without trying to edit it on the fly, which is part of what Bob was talking about.
And you know, one other little methodological thing that I think a lot of people find helpful, you know, when you're sitting and you're trying to write something and you can't write something, you just want to get up for a minute, you know? And of course, it's rewarding to get up because you're not sitting at the damn computer anymore, and now you're up somewhere else, and it feels good, and you get a cup of coffee, or you can make some tea, or you go outside, or you play with the dog, or whatever, you know? And this is just like a little $5 tip, right? When you feel that way, and you say, boy, I really want to get up right now, write for five more minutes and then get up. And now, the thing is, most of us are able to embarrass ourselves into staying another 5 minutes. You're like, come on, it's only 5 minutes, for God's sake. Just, I'm going to keep running for five more minutes and then I'm going to get up. And what you find is, many times, the 5 minutes turns into 8 minutes, and sometimes 11 minutes. Because now you've started doing something. But what happens is, you know, I teach at a music school, and music students need to practice, you know, and what they often do if they don't really want to practice is they practice until they get frustrated, and they say, okay, I want to stop practicing, and they get up and they leave, right? And what happens is practice starts ending sooner and sooner and sooner until pretty soon they can't even get up to the practice room anymore, right? And we actually have the capacity to teach ourselves to go longer by telling ourselves, I'm going to go just five more minutes, and then I'm going to get up. And what you've now done is you've broken the connection between urge to get up, get up. Urge to get up, get up. Now it's urge to get up, write 5 more minutes, then get up. It changes things in a way that is really unimaginable for many people who do that.
Is there another question? Okay, cool.
You've kind of already talked about this, but can you talk a little bit about what procrastination is and why we do it?
I'll tell you about procrastination later. But procrastination, I know, cheap humor.
Tell the dinosaur joke again.
There we go. So procrastination, right, is a lot of times we have our own concerns about whether we're going to succeed at something we've set about doing. And of course, a lot of times we don't want confirmation that what we're about to do is going to be difficult. So what we do is we say, you know what, I'll start this a little bit later. Particularly because a lot of times things in life have both approach elements and avoidance elements. So I'm gonna describe something that's related to procrastination that I used to call the Netflix problem, which back in the day, before Netflix became a streaming service, right, you'd order a bunch of DVDs. So you'd go on the web and you'd pick a bunch of things you might want to watch, and then at some point they'd be delivered to the house and then you'd watch them. And invariably what would happen is you'd order some documentary or what I call a medicine film, something that you believe you should have seen, but you're worried that it might be, you know, boring or difficult. And so you put it on your queue because in the long term that seems like a good thing to do. And then it comes home along with 2 other movies that are cheap comedies. And then what happens is that movie sits at home for like 3 months because there's no actual day on which you want to watch it. And the reason why that happens is because these have both approach elements and avoidance elements. Approach, meaning I will be a better person for having seen this. Avoidance, I'm afraid I'm going to be depressed or bored while doing it. Procrastination often involves the same trade-off. There is something that in the long term will be good for me to have done, completing this project, writing this book, doing this creative work. But in the moment, I am concerned that in that moment, I'm going to be bored, frustrated, or angry in doing it, and so I push it off until later. So the solution to that is actually a variant of what Bob was talking about, which is the 5 to 10 minute solution. That is, if I want to procrastinate something because I'm worried it's going to be difficult, boring, or frustrating, what I do is agree to do it for 5 or 10 minutes and then see what happens. So, for example, take that documentary movie and decide I'm going to watch the first 5 minutes. If I don't like it, I'll shut it off. Invariably, of course, it's a great movie and really gripping, and you watch the whole thing and you're better for having seen it. But the same thing works with these procrastination tasks. The problem is actually in getting started, not in continuing to do the work once you've gotten started. So just say, you know what, today I'm only going to work for 10 minutes on this to get started. Often that 10 minutes turns into an hour or 5 hours.
And you know, one thing I just want to add to that about when you decide to stop, and I would talk back to about my nice music students again. I mean, when I tell them, you know, they want to practice more, they think, right? I say, well, you're only going to practice, you're going to allow yourself to practice, I don't know, 45 minutes a day, which is not enough for a music major to be practicing. But you may only practice 45 minutes. But no matter how good you feel at the end of 45 minutes, you have to stop. You know, we talk a lot about the old adages who have survived, you know, years of, you know, existence in human speech. And leave them wanting more is true. And so if you're in a point where every time you engage in an activity, you continue until you can't stand it anymore, and then you stop, no matter how pleasant it is, and then you stop. What happens is stopping always feels good because you're ready to stop. So if you do what Art suggests, 5, 10 minutes, whatever, I'm going to work on this thing, and at the end of 5 or 10 minutes, I have to stop. I'm telling myself, you must stop after 5 or 10 minutes. Say, well, wait a minute, I want to do more. Too bad. You made a deal with yourself, 5 or 10 minutes. Tomorrow you can do more. And now you're creating a different kind of expectation for yourself rather than thinking about the thing that you really don't want to do and you avoid doing is something that whenever you do start doing it, you're going to do it until you can't stand it, and then you can't, and then you're going to stop.
But one thing we should talk about, though, a little bit is like, a lot of people here have employees who they want their employees to be really creative and do their best work. But how do you instill taking your time, being creative, you know, allowing yourself that space to be creative? How do you instill that in a work environment and in your employees?
So if you're a boss, right, remember that what you have at your disposal is 3 things. You have what you say, what you do, and what you reward. And you also have to remember that the people who work for you listen to those in reverse order. So what you say actually matters least. So if you say, I want you to be creative and innovative, then that's nice. But what are people doing? And in particular, what are you doing as the boss? Well, if you're not doing anything that's particularly creative or innovative because you're running around having meetings and making sure people are being productive and making sure products get out the door, well, now I'm a little leery about this whole innovation thing because I'm thinking, well, what about you? But then most importantly, what's being rewarded? If the people who get the promotions, if the people who get access to the best projects, the most opportunities, the most face time with you are people who are just being productive, who are generating income today rather than creative ideas for tomorrow, then what you're telling everybody is no matter what I say, what's being rewarded is productivity today and not creativity and innovation tomorrow. Which means that we have to be very explicit about rewarding things that are related to creativity and innovation. And one of the most important things that that means is we have to be willing to reward people who tried stuff and failed. Because most creative ideas on their first attempt are not wild successes. And so I believe that every organization, once a year, not tongue-in-cheek, but in a very real way, has to celebrate the organization's most spectacular failure of the year, where we remember that there's a big difference between failure and negligence. We don't reward negligence. People who lay down on the job, they deserve to be flogged in a 21st century appropriate way. But those people who have tried hard and done all of the work and the project still didn't go as we hoped, those people should be celebrated because in the future they're going to do great things.
And most people who get rewarded in a company, in school, whatever, get rewarded because somebody's measuring their progress. And the shorter the time scale you're measuring on, then the more you're going to drive people toward productivity over innovation, right? Because we can't predict with some reliability how quickly or how slowly innovation is going to unfold. So if we say we're measuring your performance by the day or by the week or even by the month, then you're gonna have people who are gonna safely generate things that they know can be generated in a day or a week and a month. And I think all of us experience this when we have a list of tasks that we have to complete and they require different times from us to complete them. And what do? We go to the task that will take the least time to complete first because we like the feeling it gets it good. We can check another one off our list. Now we can't check off one that takes 3 days today, but this one, which is going to take me 15 minutes, I can check that off. There's one fewer thing on my list, and that's a problem if we don't adjust the time scale for deciding how rewards get dispensed.
Which is why, of course, we all spend way too much time on email, because email is a task that where you can complete a whole cycle in about 10 or 12 minutes, right? I can read the email, I can answer the email, I can send it back off, and then I can feel really good about that. And a lot of the really important projects we have to engage in and the really innovative ones take place over much longer periods of time. It's much harder to keep yourself motivated to stick with something that is taking place over that longer time scale.
Yeah.
Is there another question?
Hi. I work in a creative industry, and I've noticed that there are people who compose and there are people who edit, and they seem to usually be mutually exclusive. And just curious about what you think about the importance of one versus the other and whether they can exist without each other.
Yeah, composition and editing. I think Bob and I are somewhat familiar with that. We've got a book coming out in the near future. And I'm more of a create a block of stuff person, and Bob is more of a hack at that block of stuff until it looks like a dinosaur person. And it's really, I think it's actually really valuable to have that dynamic to get things started. I think that the skills are sometimes a little bit different, but I also think that this idea of having different eyes looking at something is really valuable, because a lot of times you have a vision when you're creating something initially. You have a vision of what it's supposed to be and what it's going to look like. And there are often two issues with that vision. One is you often execute that vision only not quite to the point where someone else will be able to recognize it. And then in addition to that, sometimes that vision isn't as great as you thought it was. And well, so having a second person is really valuable for fixing both of those parts.
Yeah, and I think I continue to marvel at Art and how fast he can generate text. I mean, he's amazing. I still can't get over it. But I think, you know, when you have an environment where people work together in a way that everybody knows what everybody's good at and everybody knows what everybody likes to do, because there's some people who they maybe could be faster composers or better editors, but they like one thing or the other. Finding ways to get people doing the things that are rewarding to them and the things that you need, because everybody needs somebody to generate stuff. Everybody needs editors, you know, and to create that kind of synergy where people feel like they're all contributing to a project, even though they're contributing in different ways, but everybody's kind of working toward the same goal, is a really positive thing to do. I think a lot of times what people fail to do in organizations is recognize that different strengths are all valuable, you know, and it's like, well, who's the really important person? Well, you know, this person does this part of this thing really well, but this person, we really need this person to do this. And there are ways, I think, to recognize people in a way that everybody feels like their work is valued, their contributions matter. And yet, I'm not going to try to do the same thing that my colleague is doing because she's really good at that and I'm really good at this.
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny because our education system actually biases us against this.
Yeah.
We, in education is an individual sport. Right, you succeed or fail in school because of what you do individually. And the funny thing is, all of the rest of life is a team sport. And the reason that this matters is because in school, even when you do a group project, the helicopter parents swoop in and make sure that if their child does a great job, their child will get a good grade, even if other people slack off. And the problem with that is that once you get out in the world, if you do what you consider to be a great job on your project and you can't work with everyone else in a way that the entire project succeeds, you still failed. So at some point, we actually have to learn to work together and to value the group contributions, because it is the group product in the end that ultimately matters and not the contributions of particular individuals. Well, I was brilliant in this losing effort. It's just not a recipe.
You know, the other thing, too, has to do with the fixedness of roles. You know, I mean, if you think you're only this person in this company or in this organization, whatever it is, but actually there are probably some projects, some tasks where you could actually make a different contribution because of the way the task is suited. And if I can use a music metaphor for this, you know, nobody wants to play third clarinet. Everybody wants to play first clarinet. And it's even worse for trumpet players. I mean, all trumpet players want to play first trumpet. But what a lot of people do is they have auditions at the beginning of the year, they assign people to parts, and that's the part they're on, sometimes for life. You know, but there are some pieces that are written in such a way that somebody who usually plays third clarinet could actually play the first clarinet part and be quite successful, you know? And once you sort of take away the idea that everybody's locked into a particular role, and roles are flexible, and what skillful managers do is realize you could be really successful in this way, in this project. Now, you not only create a different kind of flexibility in the organization, you create a different level of interest, right? Because now people get to know what other people's jobs are like, and it's not quite so siloed as it might have been otherwise. And it's a different kind of environment that creates a sort of compatibility among various contributors to the project. It doesn't happen if only everybody only does the thing that they do, you know?
But why do we have a problem with that? Like, why do we have a problem with people who are polymaths and who have all of these different talents and skill sets? Is there something about our culture, our brains, our society, that makes us think that we have to put this person in this box and
we
that
like
makes
categories.
Us feel comfortable?
Yeah.
Yes,
I mean,
talk about that.
We like categories.
We live in a world of categories, right? I mean, what is this? You know, I guess it's a cup right now, even though it's probably a jar. You know, I mean, we like to put stuff in a category, and then once we put it in that category, a fascinating thing happens. So there's a concept called psychological essentialism. And the idea behind psychological essentialism is that once I put something into a category, I now believe that that thing has essence of that category. Now, for some things, it feels like it makes sense that that's true. So if something is a cat, it must have essence of cat, you know, which must be cat DNA or something. But it turns out we begin to do that with all sorts of categories. So if somebody is a composer versus an editor, for example, we come to believe that they have essence of that thing. And then we begin to believe that that's the role they should always fill. And so we can't necessarily, if you've got essence of composer, you can't also be this other thing. That would be awful.
You know, and I think a thing that exacerbates that mistaken view is our need to create hierarchies and to order people from best to worst. You know, I was at a lovely restaurant, one of my favorite restaurants in Los Angeles on Friday, and I was just marveling at how every member of the staff was so good at what they did, you know? But the thing that's interesting about that is, even the person who was bussing tables was doing it great, you know? And the person who was our wait person, she was great. And the manager who's walking around checking in on tables, he was great. And that whole experience only was great because everyone was great, right? I mean, if any one of those people had been subpar, that's what we would have noticed as patrons in that restaurant, right? Is that this component of it was terrible. So once you start to treat everybody in the process like they're an essential part of making it go, and I don't know if Art told me this story. You must have told me the story about the NASA janitor. Did you tell that story?
It's an apocryphal story, we think.
Yeah. It's a great story. Even if it's not true, it's an important story. So John Kennedy is walking around NASA. I mean,
he's visiting. Well, he's right.
You tell the story. I'll screw it up.
As they're starting to get ready, you know, to gear up to land a person on the moon, and he was walking around what became NASA, and he said he saw a janitor. He said, "What are you doing here? And, you know, what is your job here?" He says, "I'm sending a man to the moon." Right? But I think, you know, more generally, right, there one story that isn't apocryphal is about a guy who's actually a hospital orderly who, you know, I mean, if you're a hospital orderly, man, you spend a lot of time sticking your hands in bedpans, right, which is not the most joyous activity, I imagine. But nonetheless, right, if you believe that your job isn't stick your hand in a bedpan, but rather patient care, I'm helping the patients in this hospital to recover and to get better, then it's a fundamentally different way of looking at your job, which is very motivating for those people.
Sure.
But it also recognizes that actually the big missions in life, patient care, sending someone to the moon, and all of the things that our organizations do require the entire cast of characters and not just one particular individual who's going to make it all happen. Yeah. And before
Great.
You all run off, right, one of our missions this year at South by Southwest is to help two guys on your head take over the world. So please tell your friends, send links out, you know, get it. We're on Facebook and Twitter. We're on iTunes and Stitcher. So help everybody to find us. We love what we do, and we want to share it with as many people as we can. Thanks so much for
coming.
Thank you.